All rise. Oyez, oyez, oyez. The United States Court of Appeals for Veterans Claims is now in session. The Honorable Joseph L. Toth presiding. All who have business before this court, draw near and you shall be heard. God bless the United States and this honorable court. Please be seated.
Good morning, everyone. I'm Judge Toth. To my right is Judge Lohr, and to my left is Judge Sholin, and we're here to consider the matter of Gary L. Furco versus Dennis McDonough, Secretary of Veterans Affairs, case number 21-3467. Will counsel, beginning the appellant's counsel, please enter your appearance for the record.
Your Honor, Michael D.J. Eisenberg for the appellant. Along with me is law student Kevin Walsh, who will be serving as my assistant, but he will not be arguing today.
Okay, fantastic. Welcome. Hopefully this argument will inspire you to appear before our court sometime. Counsel, do you want to reserve some time for rebuttal?
Yes, sir. 10 minutes.
Okay.
Thank you.
So noted. Will the appellee's counsel please make an appearance for the record?
Good morning, Your Honors. Lori Jemison on behalf of the Secretary. With me at counsel's table is Edward Cassidy, who will be serving as second chair.
Good morning. So I'll just note one thing, housekeeping. If we're asking questions, you can continue to answer even if you're beyond your time limit. If you reach the time limit and you need more time, just ask for a minute or two extension. We'll oblige. Mr. Eisenberg, please proceed.
Judge Toth, Judge Sherlin, Judge Lohr, if so please the court. As a matter of law, the BVA erred in not finding Mr. Furco timely filed his notice of disagreement as it used the wrong legal standard of equitable tolling. I believe, respectfully, that the government is a little bit confused with the term jurisdiction. Jurisdiction has been a term that has been propagated and recklessly used over the years, as noted by Judge Sotomayor in recent case of Arbaugh. That being said, I think that the case in Arbaugh has provided, between Arbaugh and Wilkinson, provided this court with some guidance as how to interpret the statute of limitations when it comes to Mr. Furco's filing a one-year notice of disagreement. He timely filed.
So counsel, I don't want to pull you off your sort of legal argument, but I want to ask just about the facts of the case, because
sure.
It's a bit opaque. So, I mean, he filed his, I guess, request for extension in November of 2005. And then what happens between then and 2020? Why did it take so long to adjudicate this?
I believe because it was a matter of, well, two reasons. One, it's a matter of queue. We brought the matter up as a queue because since they denied the case, and Mr. Furco, with all due respect, is not.
So, I mean, can you kind of walk through the steps? So, I mean, he communicates in, what is it, January of 2006. He expressed a disagreement with the ruling as to that his appeal's untimely, right?
Yes.
And then I believe there's a 2010 statement of the case.
Yes.
So what took so long? Why did this take so long to adjudicate?
For us or for the VA?
For VA. I mean, what was going on behind the scenes?
To be blunt, we don't know. All I know is that what we were working on was to get service connection for the veteran to make sure that we got it at some point, and then, of course, work on an effective date, as that's how we're here today. But part of the issue is I think the claim itself technically is still a free-floating claim, that the claim is open because, if I may, under 38 CFR section 1925, he hasn't been provided proper notice of that his claim's been denied. I'm sorry, strike that. That his what his appellate rights are, given that his claim was denied. And this issue here really echoes the discussion that this court had in Kearns last Thursday. I had the opportunity to attend that here in person, and the issue was that the veteran did not get proper notice. So without that proper notice, this case is, in a sense, still technically open.
I'm sorry, why did he not get proper notice? Because it was received late, or it wasn't sent at all?
Because the notice itself was deficient.
Did you argue that below?
At this moment, I don't recall.
Okay.
So I can't answer.
My recollection, at least of the board decision, mm-hmm. your arguments rendered were related more to the mailing and whether he received it when the board believes he received it or not.
I believe the bulk of our arguments were about proper timeliness of notice of disagreement and talking about the mailbox rule, talking about when they did and didn't receive it, et cetera.
Okay. Thank you.
Judge Toth, did I answer your question? Were there more that you wanted?
Sort of. I mean, I was interested, I guess if you have no more insight than I do, that answers the question. But I was interested just in the mechanics, like, of what took so long for VA to render a decision. I thought you might have a little more insight.
Well, I believe I became the Veterans Council about 11 years ago. And I was trying to just basically resurrect and figure out what was going on. And my focus, typically when I take these type of cases, is that I want to establish service connection. And then if there's an issue about an effective date, deal with it then. But the most important thing is to get the veteran the care that he or she needs to make sure that they can take care of themselves and their family.
So, I mean, did you actively, and I understand this isn't an independent, but I mean, did you just assume that the chest pain, the sinus condition, that the shortness of breath, that these were on appeal to the board?
I assume, based on the record, that all of the medical conditions that he had were before the VA. He was being treated by the VA. The VA was well aware of his conditions prior to 2004. They knew that they got worse in 2004 with that heart attack. And in 2005, when he said, hey, I need some extra time, the straw that broke the camel's back was that heart attack in his recovery period. And that's when he said, I'm having problems here taking care of my own affairs. I can't do it. I need help. I need this extension.
I'm going to kind of jump to sort of the end of the equitable tolling argument, which
sure.
is what, I mean, what would veterans gain generally from, I mean, there's already a regulation that allows for extensions of time. What would the court doctrine imposing equitable tolling sort of add for veterans, or even in this case?
I think specifically for veterans in this case, in any case, if you have, whether it be a service-connected condition or not, that it's mental or physical condition that is preventing you from participating in your appeal or your case processing, that you should be given that extra time under CHECO to follow up with your appeal, if you so desire.
I don't read a time limitation in the governing regulation as to when you can request for an extension for good cause. I mean, it seems to suggest that You could submit the language is a bit, like every regulation, you have to kind of read it closely and sort of diagram it out to kind of make sense of it. But the language of 3.109B says, where an extension is requested after expiration of a time limit, the action required of the claimant or beneficiary must be taken concurrent with or prior to the filing of a request for extension of the time limit, and good cause must be shown, et cetera, et cetera. I know that's a mouthful, but I mean, I read that as basically allowing for extensions that are filed after the deadline would have passed, so retroactive in a sense, as long as you submit the form that would sort of complete the whatever the application is for the next step.
It, To be honest, I read that too, and I read it several times. And the part where you read concurrent has me concerned. I mean, I would love to read it the way you're suggesting, and I really hope that is the case. My concern is, whether it's this court or a higher court, that that concurrent language may mean that you have to file it within that original statute of limitations, if not within that told period for an extension. So, well,
I guess the way that I'm reading this, and I mean the government's VA is free to correct me if I'm wrong, but would be that I mean the only thing equitable tolling would add to this was if somebody, say, asked for a request but never actually filed the document, so they never. That must be taken concurrent with or prior to, like the action required of the claimant or benefit must be taken. If they didn't do that, they didn't submit the proper form or something, but they requested an extension, I mean, maybe, because that would seem to fall outside the regulation. Other than that, though, I mean, requests for extension, no matter how late, they seem to be covered by this regulation.
And under your interpretation, I would agree with you, and that he should be covered, because I believe also in his request for an extension, he said he disagrees, he just needs more time to develop the case.
Might the difference be the stop clock versus the board seem to require or imply that because he had 7 months subsequent to his surgery that he had time, so there was no more good cause, but under stop clock, because it would stop the clock, it buys you an automatic number of extra days.
Yes.
So that's the distinction that I see between applying good cause the way the VA seemed to have applied it and equitable tolling.
I agree, and I was rather kind of confused at what the government was arguing, because they had conceded in other cases that CHECO does apply. In particular, I'm thinking of the homeless veteran. Forgive me, which case was that?
CHECO.
Oh, it was CHECO, excuse me.
Yeah, but that, again, that was in an NOA situation, not an NOD situation. So perhaps that's the differential. But I hate to be formulaic or, you know, very strict here, but I just want to make sure I understand what your argument was before the court, and I understand Judge Toth asked you a question, and you're being responsive, which we appreciate. You, in your briefing before the court, focused on equitable tolling.
Yes,
correct.
Ma'am.
You did not focus on good cause.
I think good cause is inherent with equitable tolling.
But in relation to the regulation itself, as opposed to equitable tolling, which exists outside of the statute, you did not argue that VA erred in its application of the regulation of failing to provide a good cause extension to your client.
If I recall correctly, correct. We did argue for a good cause as a principle of equitable tolling as in our jury.
But not in terms of the regulatory application. Okay.
I think you may be correct, Your Honor. But yeah, I still think that as a whole, equitable tolling, whether it be by statute or by jurisprudence, that it has been reasonably raised in the record by the BVA decision itself. So that is properly before the court.
Mr. Eisenberg,
yes,
I'd like
yes,
to
sir.
Follow up, if I may, on a question that Judge Toth asked you
yes,
earlier
sir.
With respect to what would veterans gain by equitable tolling in this case, and that is, should this court's holding in Mr. Furco's case be constrained by NODs under legacy appeals, or is this something that should also be looked at, recognizing that the 7105 was amended for the AMA appeals? But what is your position on that?
My position is that equitable tolling, if I heard the question correctly, is that equitable tolling applies in both situations.
Why is that?
Because based on congressional intent, we look at what they said, what the statute says, and the statute's clear about what the time frame is. However, you cannot be so hyper-focused as to look only at the statute. You have to look at the statutory language around it. And there is nothing complex about any of the language suggesting that equitable tolling cannot be applied. There is a strong government interest in ensuring that our veterans are protected and taken care of since they sacrificed life and limb for us. And in this equitable tolling matter, for Mr. Furco, let alone, I would suggest, for any other veteran, that there is a finite period here. We have a finite period of he had a heart attack, he had a heart surgery, and he had a 3-month recovery period. All of that should have been known by the secretary, perhaps not by lawyers, as we are lawyers, not doctors, but also any of that information could easily be found on the public and on the internet. Look at WebMD. You know, how long does immediate hospitalization require for a heart operation? How much recovery time is typically associated with that? What kind of medications are you going to be on? Going back to, I forget if it was Judge Scholin or Judge Toth, we were talking about his condition after the surgery, and he was on Pravlix, I think, at the time, which is known to cause confusion. So add that to his already other service-connected conditions that have caused him great pain and confusion and other mental distress. It was at a time that he simply couldn't handle his legal affairs, which I think would give 4 days for the hospital operation and stay, and then about 3 months of recovery.
Okay, and you haven't specifically mentioned Irwin or the presumption, but I assume that your argument that it should apply to both, regardless of the change in the statute.
Yes.
Is relevant for that purpose.
Yes, and I
thank you.
Sorry, we hadn't gone over there yet. So.
Thank you.
So the way that I sort of approach this is, you know, first, is the question jurisdictional or not, the statute jurisdictional or not, and then the next step, assuming it's not kind of the Arellano inquiry of should equitable tolling be applied. And that's where I'd like to talk to you a little bit.
Yes, ma'am.
The fact that the regulation that Judge Toth was discussing with you, 3.109B, provides a good cause extension, what does that do to the question of whether equitable tolling should be available?
I think it emphasizes that it should. I think that's language that, when interpreted holistically, suggest that, actually, I think, well, more than suggest, that equitable tolling should be available to veterans.
So the idea that it has already been addressed, like sort of the field has been covered by this regulatory exception.
Yes, ma'am.
Does not imply or does not dictate that there should not be another equitable also extension.
I don't think that one piece of statutory language would serve as a preventive bar. Usually, that's not complex enough. There are a litany of, say, 16 other limiting languages in there. Period. And given that the courts and Congress have really put a thumb on the scale for the benefit of the veteran, I couldn't imagine that equitable tolling would be something that would be denied to any veteran.
I mean, I appreciate that. I mean, equitable tolling applies generally to statutes, right, that create a right of action against the U.S., and the idea is there's a waiver of sovereign immunity, and then is that waiver jurisdictional, basically? Usually it doesn't apply to regulations, right? And there's a case, Sebelius from 2012, that said it really does. I mean, it can to HHS regs, but it's not meant to displace the sort of regulatory structure that's already in place. It's a court-created doctrine. I mean, what would you say to that? It's not meant to apply to regulations.
I disagree. I mean, Alito, I think, in Henderson was talking about how Title I courts, Article I courts and Article I processes are not as stringent as Article III. And
I don't mean to cut you off, but I mean, that would be a great argument if Like, let's say there were no exceptions. Let's say that 7105, one-year exception, had no, there was no good cause exception. There was no regulation that allowed any. Then I think you'd have a pretty strong argument that based on the way veteran statutes are read generally, that equitable tolling applies. But I mean, it strikes me that there already is a regulation that provides means for an extension of time that's actually less restrictive than equitable tolling. I mean, equitable tolling is a pretty, you have to kind of thread a needle to get it. I mean, you have to show extraordinary circumstances and due diligence, and there's a causation element. I mean, there's a lot to sort of prove in that. Why do we even need it, is I guess the question. This is a refrain of the question I asked you earlier. I mean, what do people really gain from now making the board do equitable tolling?
The absolute insurance that our veterans are taking care of. I mean, isn't that what this comes down to?
Right, but I mean, if there's an adjudication that offers a lower, burden of proof, say, right? Why not, like, that already exists. Why add another more stringent one? I mean, anybody who can demonstrate the equitable tolling is likely going to be able to demonstrate good cause. It's an easier standard. So why would we just append this to what already exists?
Well, I think in part because the court can't determine its own finding of facts, my concerns is that the BVA decision, when it said that two processes mixed up. One is the current recent litigation, and then, of course, also what happened back then, because they basically said that, your heart attack and your time in the hospital was not enough to cause any tolling, for the causation element of the statute. So, I mean, this certainly serves as a prophylactic, the equitable tolling in the jurisprudence sense serves as a prophylactic measure to make sure that everything else was done correctly before the agency. So we got to make sure that the courts, I see my time is almost up, courts have an opportunity to make sure that the agency and the government are doing what they're supposed to be doing.
Okay, I have one more question.
I have several.
Okay. So we'll as long as you're answering questions, just you can stay up there. But you mentioned Q earlier in the beginning. I see a bit about the case history and the behind the scenes, and you said something about a Q claim. Was this decision ever final? This the veterans' January 2006 expression of disagreement with the ruling about the timeliness, like that was that what you challenged at Q?
I'd have to double check my notes, but I'm pretty sure that the Q was that the government did err regarding the determining that it wasn't timely.
Okay.
And I think that was going more towards if you take a real close look at all of the pinpoint dates that I believe I expressed in my rebuttal brief and also in my request for reconsideration before the BVA, really goes step by step of this is the day of the decision, this is the date that it was mailed, certain holidays and weekends kind of pushed it forward. They're saying that they received it on November 22nd or 28th, and then they go back and say, well, actually it's November 14th, or this is what we're basing it on, based on the letterhead of Mr. Furco's notice to the court of an extension. But what's interesting about that is you don't go based, for the veteran, you don't go based on the date on the letter, you go based on the envelope. And if there's no envelope, there's no stamped envelope, in the RBA. So if they're saying they received it on the 14th, that means he mailed it on the 9th. Or actually, I think the 9th is a Saturday, and the Friday before might have been a holiday. So if you go back, he timely filed it, even without all of these extensions. Or, the equitable tolling such extensions. And I may have gone off on a tangent. I apologize.
Okay, no, I just wanted to verify it. So if I'm hearing you correctly, the claim basically just stayed in limbo for about 15 years.
Yes, sir.
Judge Sholin mentioned that she has some questions.
Yes, ma'am.
The board decision and the appellant and the secretary cite to a case called Percy. Are you familiar with that case?
I'm sorry?
Percy?
Yes, ma'am.
How would we distinguish the language that unfavorably compares the substantive appeal language as being more permissive and the NOD language as being more prescriptive?
Well, forgive me, I guess. I'm a little confused. What is the question?
The board cited to Percy, mm-hmm. and Percy found a substantive appeal to be subject to equitable tolling because it was not jurisdictional.
Right.
In its analysis, Percy compared the substantive appeal statutory language to the notice of disagreement statutory language. And that analysis made a comparison that they believed the reason the language was so prescriptive with regard to NOD was a highlighting of the fact that it was not prescriptive and therefore not jurisdictional for substantive appeals. So, I mean, do you believe that to be dicta? Do you think that that's a holding?
I think that given what we've seen in recent cases from the Supreme Court, Arello, Wilkins, et cetera, that it may have been interpreted wrong.
Okay, thank you. And I have one more question.
Yes, ma'am.
If we did apply the stop-clock approach, one of the elements would be that the appellant needs to show due diligence during that time, not during the entire period, but during the extraordinary circumstance. If so, what did Mr. Furco do to exercise diligence during his extraordinary circumstance?
During his extraordinary circumstance?
That's what the standard is.
How could he do anything? I mean, you know, when you're unconscious and being operated on, when your mind is clouded by medication and other mental health related issues connected to service, there's nothing he can do. So to say that he was being due diligent or not due diligent is insulting to the veteran. Let alone the veterans who are unable to act during their so-called due diligence. I think due diligence happens by the fact that he pursued the matter within what he thought was the time frame allowed. And quite frankly, strike that. Was there anything else, Your Honor?
Mr. Eisenberg,
yes,
Judge Toth asked you about Sebelius. I have a little different question related to Sebelius. Mm-hmm. So in that case, the Supreme Court said that it had never applied the Irwin presumption to an agency's internal appeal deadline.
Mm-hmm.
But that's essentially what the appellant is requesting that this court do. And so my question is, how would we reconcile, would this court reconcile that statement in the Supreme Court's decision in Sebelius?
If I may have a second, Your Honor.
Of course.
And I apologize, could you please repeat your question to make sure I heard it clearly?
Sure. It's essentially the Supreme Court's decision and its statement, and I'll repeat it here, that it had never applied the Irwin presumption to an agency's internal appeal deadline.
But nothing says that it can't.
We can be like a trial court here. I have the case. If you want to read it during the rebuttal period, I can hand it to you.
Oh, thank you.
Quick. If you want to approach. If you want to, because I have the same question. So if you want to kind of skim it during the rebuttal period. Okay.
Thank you. Are there any other questions before?
No.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor. I appreciate the assistance.
counsel.
Good morning, Your Honors, and may it please the court. I'm going to actually deviate from what I planned to say and just kind of clear up some of the facts since the bench seemed to have a few questions. I think it might assist in kind of the process here. With regard to the question of how long, why did it take so long to get to this point, appellant actually filed to reopen his service connection claims. I cannot recall the year, but that was granted in a May 2017 board decision to reopen the heart condition claim. That's actually in the record at 1769.
And was that the same condition?
Yes. Okay. That was for the chest pains and what essentially was the heart condition. And in that same decision, the board remanded based on Manley Con because the appellant had not received an SOC for the timeliness issue with the NOD. So to some degree, that is why there's such a large gap in time. He actually had a service connection claim pending running at the same time after that remand.
So, So between, I mean, so for 12 years, there's no action at all. But it mentions a 2010 statement of the case. Is that for the same underlying conditions?
Yes, that was after he filed to reopen.
Okay, so when did he file to reopen? Do you know that?
I don't recall, and unfortunately, I don't
But sometime between the January 6th communication and the obviously the 2010 statement of the case. Okay.
Yes.
Okay, no, that's helpful. Thank you.
And I think that really what happened is by the time it got to the board and they went to adjudicate, they realized that the issue of timeliness with the NOD was still out there. Okay. Obviously, the secretary does not believe that 7105 should have equitable tolling applied to it. We agree with the analysis that was provided in Percy v. Shinseki with the distinction between the language for 7105B, which governs NODs, and 7105D, which governs notices of appeal. So to that end, articulating some of those distinctions that the court made, one of the things was that 7105B does not contain any permissive language at all. It simply says that the NOD must be filed within the one-year time period versus 7105.
Yeah, but I mean, I mean, you're allowed to draft a regulation that grants extensions. I mean, it's hard to argue that to say something is jurisdictional means the agency would be acting ultra vires if it even considered the matter. I mean, it's hard to argue something's jurisdictional when the agency is the right to grant extensions. I mean, those two things are almost completely mutually exclusive.
Which, to Your Honor's point earlier, that's exactly why you don't need equitable tolling, because while the statute itself allowed and delegated rulemaking authority, regulatory authority to the secretary chose to take that authority, acknowledging that there were going to be instances where perhaps there would be an issue with the timing issue, whether that's
right.
The,
and so you may not. I don't know if you know the answer to this, but so 5110, right? That was the provision at issue in Arellano. There's no regulation that allows the secretary to sort of grant extensions for or tweak the effective dates for equitable reasons. Not that you're aware of.
No, but my understanding is based on the review of the start of the regulation for 3.109 is that it was actually kind of put in place for equitable purposes, such that, for instance, in instances where there is an issue with notice, let's say.
Sure.
If 7105 was so strictly applied where VA was at fault for not providing proper notice, then the veteran would not have any relief at all, which, of course, is inherently unfair. So the purpose of 3.109 in the first place was to kind of cover what appellant is seeking right now, which is to make sure that while there's not any specific permissive language in 7105, the regulatory authority.
But I mean, you can argue that the permissive language in 7105 actually, I think, helps your case in the sense that, like I mentioned before, I mean, normally we consider equitable tolling when there's a statute that provides no exceptions and there's no regulatory exception, and then it's just whether or not equitable consideration should be included. Here, the fact that, so with 5110, I mean, there are 16 exceptions, but there's nothing more. I mean, the Secretary cannot grant exceptions to the effective date rules. And so the court, and you know, it's basically covered by a statute, only by a statute. And so equitable tolling was really the only thing that they could consider. Here, I mean, the statute itself is permissive language that allows the Secretary to craft a regulation. The regulation mentioned here has an a provision for extensions of time, right?
Yes.
So I, even though it plays against the whole analysis that the court has for statutes, I mean, I think you can make a case that it's that analysis just isn't meant to apply to regulations.
Yes, Your Honor, I do agree with that. And much to the point that I believe that Judge Sheldon was making earlier, the case law is clear that once the issue of equities has already been addressed, there's no reason for the court to intercede and take it a step further. It's already been done.
I don't think that was the point I was making.
I'm sorry. But the case law is clear on that. Like, the equities have already been applied here in creating that exception to not foreclose the possibility of relief in instances where there is going to be a timeliness issue. But to that end, as is demonstrated by the facts in this particular case, Mr. Furco was not without recourse at all. He did exactly what he needed to do in order to reopen his claim, and it was reopened. Of course, the issue of effective.
But he was, he was entitled. The issue of the timeliness of the appeal, right, under the regulation, that's a separately appealable issue.
Yes.
Itself. Now, he, in January of 2006, basically expressed his disagreement with that. I mean, he had the right to have that adjudicated.
Yes, which is the subject of this particular board decision.
Right. Right. I know you personally are not at fault here. So, but the optics of this don't look great for the agency. I mean, you have a veteran who asked for a one-week extension of time. And then the agency takes 15 years to basically adjudicate that and says, no, he can't have a week, but it takes us 15 years. I mean, that doesn't look good.
I agree with you, Your Honor. And unfortunately, we're kind of looking at this from the end looking backwards. I can see that there are probably things that could have been done in a timelier fashion. So I do agree with you in that regard. However, I will also point out that appellant did not specify how much time he was seeking, which kind of came to light in the course of this litigation in appellant's briefs.
I know, but the regulation doesn't require that. The regulation required that he submit the appropriate form along with his request for an extension. I mean, he seems to have done that.
Agree.
In reading the recent Supreme Court cases talking about the idea of the, what I'm calling sort of the second step, you know, not is it jurisdictional, but should tolling apply? One of the threads that I sort of pulled from there was the idea of, does it affect the payment, the amount of payment of benefits, or does it affect like sort of the right to keep having process. And the Supreme Court seemed to find favor in the ones that continue to find process and not the ones that just allow more pain, like in Arellano would allow for more money. So this case to me is more like the more process case. So why shouldn't we apply that reasoning here?
Well, Your Honor, even if the court were to apply that reasoning and get to the point of questioning whether or not equitable tolling should apply, the court should also still consider, as the Supreme Court has done in the evolution of this issue, because it seems to have been going on a while and they've kind of gone one way and then turned and gone another way. But in the evolution of this particular issue, it seems that the thing that is most important to them is the statutory language, as well as, and then when they get to the issue of whether or not it should be applied, what is actually at play. And in this particular instance, we're talking about a process before the VA, which is an internal process, and quite frankly, applying equitable tolling would kind of upend that process. Not only in potentially affecting the amount of claims that would be affected by it in the respect of workload and that type of thing, but also it's not appropriate in cases where the equities have already been applied.
Well, if I can back up, let's look at the substantive appeal process. Percy allows for equitable tolling in the substantive appeal context, right? And there is also a good cause exception in the substantive appeal process, correct?
Yes.
Has Percy upended the VA appellate process in that the board gets thousands and thousands and thousands of appeals a year?
It's more so the difference between that is, so the change in allowing the substantive appeal to be told to the board is a little bit different, only because when we're looking at the NOD, especially under the legacy system, the NOD has a different function than the substantive appeal to the board. The NOD has essentially triggers the SOC, which in it triggers the SOC, it triggers the next things that need to happen before you even get to that point, versus as the court decided in Percy, essentially the substantive appeal is just a matter of telling the board, hey, go ahead and...
Not the court, the board.
Excuse me. the agency telling the board to just go ahead and like start looking at the case. But the SOC also affords the appellant an additional level of review. There's things that go on as far as development below. So it essentially could add additional time within the process before the agency.
But I don't mean to be argumentative, but doesn't it seem to me that the same thing applies with the substantive appeal in that it allows for another level of review, and if the board should find an error in the duty to assist in a legacy case, it has to send it back for more process. So it's the same, and they could even consider new evidence before the board. I mean, it's the same steps. It's just potentially less of them, I would say, but that's really the only distinction I see.
Well, respectfully, Your Honor, in theory, what you said is true. However, that is also on the merits. This is before you even get to the point of if we're looking at the fact that NODs are separately appealable, that issue generally is taken care of before you even get to the merits issue. So then you go through the process. There is the issue of equitable tolling, whether it's applied, who's applying it, whether it's the agency or whether it's the board. and then it has to go back for the appellant to have their actual process on the merits of their case. So it actually does add an extra layer as far as delay, which
is the timeliness. Is an NOD as to timeliness of a NOD, is that adjudicated by the VA in the RO in the first instance?
It's adjudicated by the board in the first instance.
So if the appellant's NOD is deemed untimely, the original NOD is deemed untimely by the agency of original jurisdiction, and the appellant files a notice of disagreement with that determination, that goes directly to the board. The agency of original jurisdiction doesn't determine that in the first instance. I think you're correct, but I'm just trying to make sure I'm clear on the process.
There is an SOC issued, but yes, it goes to the board.
Okay.
So in that process, if they say, okay, it's timely, then it has to be remanded, and then the appellant has to start over, you know, proceed with the merits of their claim and development. So that adds an extra layer of waiting, quite frankly, for them to straighten out that process before we get to the actual merits.
Although the legacy cases are diminishing in number.
Yes, they are.
Thank you.
Ms. Johnson, so under the Veterans Appeals Modernization Act, Congress amended 7105 to add E1C, which states a question as the timeliness or adequacy of the notice of disagreement shall be decided by the board. And my question is, what weight does the Secretary give to Congress's decision to amend 7105 in that way, to add that language?
Actually, that language was also in play at the time of this particular rating decision as well. Congress has explicitly allowed that to be an appealable issue. So the Secretary does acknowledge that seems to be Congress creating a process where an appellant could challenge and have an opportunity to provide an explanation because certainly there could be Maryland issues. There's a myriad of scenarios that could come up that would need to necessarily be brought to VA's attention that, you know, we may not otherwise be unnoticed of. So that particular provision, by making it appealable, is actually favorable to the veteran.
So I'm sorry, can you clarify when you say that language is in play? And I don't want to put words in your mouth, but I think you said in this case, but can you explain what you mean by that?
Oh, I just mean that in the statute as it existed in 2004 also contained the same language. So that is exactly what appellant here did, is he appealed to the board the timeliness of the NOD. And the significance of that language is that it's favorable to the veteran to allow them to appeal to the board, as opposed to just having to start their claim over. Now, while this particular veteran did both, in a downstream issue type of way, one being resolved favorably could essentially affect effective date at a later time.
I'm sorry, can you direct me, Ms. Jemison, where that language appeared in the 7105 pre-MA under the legacy provision?
Court's indulgence.
Mm-hmm.
I apologize, Your Honor. Apparently, I did not bring the printout of it with me.
I have a copy.
Okay.
Sort of following in Judge Toth's footsteps.
Would you like to approach the bench?
Thank you. May I approach?
Oh, actually, this will be the current version. That won't help you. I can give you the old version.
I'll pass it to the clerk.
Thank you.
We need a bailiff here.
New duties. I apologize, Your Honor. What was your question? I'm sorry.
So the question was, as a result of the amendment that Congress made for AMA, and I'll read the sentence again. It's under 7105B1C states, a question as to timeliness or adequacy of the notice of disagreement shall be decided by the board. And my question was related to what weight the Secretary placed on that amendment.
Your Honor, that is actually consistent with the creation of the exception under 3.109 in the respect of it affords the board some room to grant extensions or to allow for more time by allowing that to be an appealable issue because it gets it to the board as opposed to it stopping with the RO. So as opposed to the RO making the determination it's late, end of claim, it allows the appellant to then say, hey, I take issue with the RO saying that this is late, and it affords them an additional avenue to pursue the timeliness issue.
So taking the language from the reg and putting it, is that, I'm not sure I understand.
It's, so the amendment to the statute is actually favorable to the veteran in the respect that it allows, instead of cutting off their claim, for untimeliness, it allows them to bring an appeal to the board and say, I disagree with the fact that the RO is saying that I am untimely. And that kind of plays into the reason why there's a regulation that allows for an extension of time, because the board can also look at that and look at the NOD and the, if reasons are provided, the NOD and whatever type of information is provided by the appellant and determine whether or not that would fit underneath an extension. So essentially, it just acts as a favorable vehicle for the appellant to have an additional opportunity, which is consistent with the pro-veterans system that we're working in.
So does that indicate an intent to give the board equitable authority?
Not per se. It gives the secretary the opportunity to apply the regulation that it created, because otherwise, unless there is a it gives the secretary the opportunity to apply the regulation, because otherwise there would not be a space for them to do so. If the claim cuts off at the RO and there's no extension for good time filed within the time period, because surely the appellant can file the extension either before the expiration of the time period or afterward. So if it's filed afterward, the RO inherently is going to say no. They don't have the authority to make the decision on that issue. The board does. So it allows the board to actually apply the regulation and determine whether an extension is warranted.
I mean, so the good cause standard under the reg, I mean, it's not purely discretionary, but it's something like a totality of the circumstances, right? I mean, we've never spelled out exactly what good cause is. It's not purely discretionary. I mean, it's not, okay, well, I like this person, right? It's not standardless. I mean, it has some, I mean, they're looking for some factors.
Yes. It essentially enumerates what is what they're looking for kind of on its face, but essentially, no, it's definitely not as stringent of a standard as would be required for equitable tolling.
Right, and I mean, am I right? I don't read a time limit into the reg. I mean, somebody theoretically could submit a request for extension 10 years later. I mean, it would be, I imagine, pretty difficult to demonstrate good cause, like amnesia, or, you know, like you were in it's like a soap opera. You woke up from a coma or something. But theoretically, I mean, if you submitted that in an NOD, the board would have to consider your request for extension even retroactively.
Yes.
Okay.
Your Honors, as I stated before, there is absolutely no reason to go beyond the statute here and the regulation to apply equitable tolling to NODs. And we would just ask that the court affirm the board's decision in that regard and not take what appellant has suggested as the opportunity to kind of redo something that's already been done because it's not necessary based on the existing case law. Thank you, Your Honors. If there's no further questions.
Yeah, thank you.
Thank you.
Counsel, you time for rebuttal?
Your Honor, may I approach the bench to return your case?
Sure, let's keep it going. That's fine. You can add to me. Thanks.
If I may have just one moment. Your Honor, I believe to address your question regarding Sebelius is that the two cases between Sebelius and here is quite different in that this is a very pro-claimant agency versus DHS trying to recoup funds. That being said, you know, also look at Sotomayor's concurring opinion. That, you know, basically she agrees with the result, but she doesn't say that equitable tolling is something that is not available in the agency process.
I guess the point would be, you don't need us to recognize equitable tolling to win, right? I mean, we could review the propriety of the board's finding that Mr. Virgo hadn't demonstrated good cause. I mean, that's something that's currently on appeal to us. I mean, the reg, I think, is an easier sell than us both imposing and finding equitable tolling, right?
Yes, but if necessary, we have the equitable jurisprudence process of equitable tolling as a backup. You know, one thing that, if I heard correctly, and forgive me, I was looking at Sevilla while agency counsel was up here, that I don't believe that the denial in 2006 provided any steps as to what he could do to, quote unquote, appeal the denial for an untimely filing, except to reopen the claim.
No, but I think I think you're in the clear on that issue. Okay. I mean, I understand that the January 2006 expression of disagreement, at that time, they didn't have the kind of formal claims requirement that they do now, would have been sufficient to kind of put it into appellate status, remain there.
Yes, sir. So, were there any other questions by the court that they'd like me to address?
No, thank you.
Then we'll rest on our presentation and simply put, say that as a matter of law, the BVA erred.
Okay.
and its denial of Mr. Forgo's claim.
Thank you. This matter will be taken under consideration.